Chair, the case is submitted. We'll hear argument next, number 87-157, Allied Tube versus Indian Head. Mr. Frankel, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the Court's writ in this case to the Second Circuit brings up for review questions relating to the scope and meaning of the so-called Noor-Pennington Doctrine, a doctrine which, as this Court knows, made clear that the Sherman Act is not applicable to combinations of businessmen associated together for the purpose of attempting to influence or for the purpose of seeking legislation beneficial to themselves in association and unfavorable to their competitors. That Noor Doctrine is based, as your honors know, on a construction of what the Sherman Act, read by itself, was meant to cover and not to cover, and on overtones of the First Amendment affecting the right of association and the right to petition the government. We're concerned in this case with the National Electrical Code, the NEC as I shall call it, which I'm holding up, a 700-plus page compilation from antennas to X-rays, it doesn't have any Y's or Z's, which is compiled every 3 years by the National Fire Protection Association, a private standard-setting organization. This code is, as the Second Circuit pointed out, the most widely disseminated and most widely adopted standards code in the world. It is adopted as legislation, as it appears in this book, line by line, in a majority of the states of the United States and in a majority of the large municipalities. It's adopted by most of the other states with relatively modest amendments. This controversy began when Carlon, as it's been called, a subsidiary of the respondent, we've referred to Carlon throughout the case rather than Indian Head. Carlon undertook to have a new Article 331 added to this code, which would have included as suitable equipment electric non-metallic tubing made of polyvinyl chloride. That tubing is a kind of raceway for carrying wires through the walls and floors of buildings. And the objective of Carlon was to have that product included in this code because, as we all agree, without such inclusion, it couldn't sell it in most of the places throughout the United States where that code is law. There's been evidence throughout this case that there was at all times at a material scientific evidence that this tubing made of polyvinyl chloride is unsafe, that it was hazardous to human life in the event of fire, which is what that code is, of course, ultimately concerned with. I might mention that since a footnote in our friend's brief suggests that that statement is misleading, I should say that it page 4A of the petitioner's appendix, you will find the circuit reflecting the concurrent findings of both lower courts that there was scientific evidence of the hazardousness of this product at the material times in this case. Now, the way you get something into this code is by a multi-step process that the circuit described. First, the proposed article goes before a so-called code-making panel. Whatever happens there is reviewable at a second step, a membership meeting of the members of the NFPA, the Fire Protection Association. If there is a result which the party adversely affected wishes to complain, there's an appeal to a standards council and to the board of directors, and then if there has been a rejection of a proposed article, there is a procedure for seeking a tentative interim amendment which would put the proposed article into the code. Now, this whole case centers on the second step, the membership vote, which took place in this case on May 20, 1980. The code-making panel had at first rejected ENMT, their product, then changed its decision and approved it subject to the membership meeting. At that next step, all members of the NFPA, and there were at the time 31,500 members, all members who've held membership for 30 days or more are eligible to vote. Now, the members are explicitly, and as everyone understands, interest group representatives. Quoting from the NFPA's description of itself, interested members, and most members are interested, as part of the process that the NFPA describes and extols, and I quote, have the privilege of designating their representatives and instructing them how to vote. Now, allied within that rule, as part of the effort of itself and other companies in competition with this polyvinyl product, collected 155 members for that May 20 meeting. And those members included executives of the company, employees, sales agents, and even the wife of a sales director. Other steel companies also gathered whatever members they could so that among them, these alleged conspirators had 230 votes at that meeting. The final vote went 394 to 390 against Carlin. As I've said, however, and as the jury found, this was by no means the last step. The jury said in its findings, this vote did not effectively determine that ENMT would not be in the code. It said that vote was a substantial factor, but that Carlin had, and I'm quoting another finding, a full and effective appeal from the vote of the membership, and that the vote and allies, the petitioner's behavior, had not deprived Carlin of full and effective access to the NFPA.
Mr. Frankel, the case was submitted to the jury on interrogatories.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. And the answers to those interrogatories will be found at pages 23, 4, and 5 of this slender joint appendix. Carlin took its appeal to the Standards Council and to the Board of Directors, where it was defeated. On those appeals, the record shows there's plenary authority to consider whatever the appellant wishes to present, including even new evidence. And then Carlin sought, as the last step in this process, a tentative interim amendment. It was defeated at every stage, and the most interesting in some respects was the last stage, because in the denial of the tentative interim amendment, the TIA, the directors made clear that one of the serious considerations leading to that denial at that time was there are still unresolved doubts about safety. Thereafter, as the briefs show, and nobody disagrees on this, in 1984, Carlon's product was allowed into the code, but with a limitation to three-story buildings, again reflecting 3 years later, there's still lingering concerns about safety in the event of fire. However, going back to October 1981, Carlon, as a result of that rejection of its article, brought this lawsuit against Allied and the NFPA, later dropped the NFPA, pursued the case against Carlon. The gist of the lawsuit, as we think is perfectly clear, is stated in the language of the complaint, quoted at pages 13 and 14 of the joint appendix, that this suit was brought, and I quote, because of the adoption and application of the NEC by states and municipalities, and I end the quote there, without their Article 331, and they say because of that adoption of that code without 331 by all these states and municipalities, they lost a tremendous lot of sales, which is not disputed. Our client asserted the Norah Pennington Doctrine as a defense, and I'll try to abbreviate. The judge, the trial judge, reserved on that, let the case go to the jury. There was a verdict for Carlon, including the quaint finding by the jury that Allied, our client, had subverted the NFPA process. But after that verdict, and then a second portion of the trial, I should have said it was a bifurcated trial, liability first, then damages, there was a verdict for $3.8 million, a trebled, plus, of course, attorney's fees. The trial judge set that verdict aside, holding that the Norah Pennington defense was, after all, a valid defense. On Carlon's appeal, the circuit unanimously reversed and held that Norah Pennington does not apply. And that's what brings us here. We think that the Court of Appeals, by the time it got to this legal aspect of the case, lost sight of the facts it had so carefully stated, and utterly, with all deference, utterly misconceived what Norah Pennington, what the Norah decision itself was about, what its facts were, and what it held. The Court will recall that the Norah decision, which had its 27th anniversary last Saturday, related to what the Court, all three courts, described as a vicious, corrupt, and fraudulent publicity campaign addressed to the general public by a railroad association in an effort to poison public opinion against the trucking industry and thereby, as the hoped-for next step, to achieve legislation hostile to truckers. The Court said that the campaign by the railroads included conduct that Justice Black described for a unanimous bench as reprehensible, the so-called third-party technique of representing that opinions and expressions coming actually from the railroads were the emanations of citizens and civic associations. The Court held, nevertheless, that all this was a part of an attempt to influence legislation by means of that publicity campaign.
Mr. Therefore, Frankel, what does the Court's holding in Norah rest on? Is it the right to petition the government? Is that the constitutional basis of it?
No, I think strictly, Justice O'Connor, Norah rests on a construction of the Sherman Act, strictly, that whatever else you might say about that reprehensible conduct, It was not conduct at which the Sherman Act was aimed.
That interpretation of the Sherman Act required because of some constitutional provision, do you suppose?
I would say, to try my best to report Justice Black's opinion accurately, that after saying that this is not Sherman Act conduct, he went on to say in that many words that if we were to rule otherwise, we would run into serious concerns under the First Amendment because we would be cutting into, or we might be cutting into, the right of association and the right through association to petition the government. But I think scholars have agreed, and I think it's fair to say, that it was only two cases later in the California trucking case that this court came down and explicitly said that one leg of the Nora Pennington Doctrine is indeed the First Amendment. I have concentrated on the court's principles as I understand them initially on the Sherman Act, because I think Nora did concentrate that way. And what Justice Black said is, whatever else you say about this conduct, which, by the way, was illegal conduct, as the Third Circuit had held, whatever else you say about it, this isn't what the Sherman Act was about. It's not a case of people giving up their trade freedom. It's not a case of price fixing or boycotts or market divisions or any other kind of market behavior about which Senator Sherman and his friends were thinking. It is an attempt to influence public opinion with the goal of getting legislation. And that's not Sherman Act conduct, even before you reach the First Amendment. And then, of course, the Justice and this Court unanimously did reach the First Amendment. Now, in the opinion for the Second Circuit of Judge Lombard, they run a series of distinctions of Noor. And again, with great respect, it's our submission that every one of them is clearly wrong. They say first that Noor's holding, in the language of the circuit, depended upon the unique nature of petitions directed to the government in our political system. Well, that's a mistake. There were no petitions directed to the government at all in the Noor case. The Noor case, as Justice Black wrote over and over again, was about this campaign of publicity addressed to the general public with the hope or anticipation that the public in turn would have an impact on the legislature. Now, that was indirect. And Judge Lombard writes that our conduct is somehow distinguishable because it is indirect. Well, we say it's not distinguishable at all.
Well, I suppose in a sense it's direct insofar as members of Congress are also members of the public.
In that sense, Justice O'Connor, it is direct, but I don't think there is a word in the Noor opinion that describes directness in any such sense. The opinion is about this broad effort, vicious and corrupt, to poison the public mind. And to be sure, that includes members of legislatures. But then, when you speak of directness and indirectness, let's compare the cases. This book goes directly into the statute books, and everybody knows that. Influencing the contents or exclusions from this NEC leads directly, certainly, and predictably to legislation. And our friends knew that. And that's why when they sued, leaving aside certain second
Judge
thoughts.
Michael, it is true that it goes directly into the statute books, but only after the various legislatures decide to put it in the statute books.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct. And similarly, whatever public influence was exerted by that vicious publicity campaign in Noor only eventuated in the legislative conduct that the railroad sought when the legislators took the action that is for them to take.
And your position is, Mr. Frankel, that because of Nora Pennington, the defendants here could act unreasonably in influencing that code?
Yes, Your Honor. Whatever unreasonably means, I think it is clear under Knorr and under the decisions since then that, though we would not use such characterizations, the defendants could have acted viciously and reprehensibly and perhaps, though I don't want to press this, illegally, as long as what they were doing was attempting to influence legislation. The Solicitor General says someplace that, of course, the Knorr Doctrine would not cover kidnapping legislators. I think that takes us away from our subject, because I don't think anybody's ever thought till now that the Sherman Act related to kidnapping legislators. But where the conduct is arguably Sherman Act, and Justice Black said this kind of attempt to influence the legislature is not, the fact that it turns out to be such an attempt because of what are found in the end to be the real meanings of the Sherman Act in the light of the First Amendment preclude Sherman Act liability. I might say there's a Seventh Circuit case cited in our brief which involved actual bribery of city council members. It's the Metro Cable case in 1975. And there again, going much farther than we have to go in this case, the court read Knorr to apply. Judge Lombard said that there's a distinction that is important here between the submission of a group's, and I'm quoting, of a group's recommendations to the government and the antecedent conduct which generated those recommendations. And again, that's a similar, in our view, a similar misapprehension of what Knorr was about. There was no submission of a group's recommendations to the legislature so far as the Knorr analysis of the problem was concerned. There was only the antecedent conduct. If anything, if you're looking to the submission to a legislature, this code, as a practical matter, everyone knows, is a submission to the legislature. Now, in a number of states, although there is indeed the intervening official act of the legislature, it is a fact, undisputed in this record, that the adoption of this code is automatic. And I suppose everyone who knows more about the way...
Mr. Frankel, I thought it was not really undisputed that the adoption of the code was automatic. I forget whether it's Judge Lombard's opinion or the respondents. We say that it is amended in places and that only half the states adopted verbatim.
Oh, yes. I said in a number of states, Your Honor. Actually, in Judge Lombard's opinion, I believe it may be the first footnote, you will find him saying that this is the most widely adopted code, and if I just find his first footnote rather than mine, I might be able to read to Your Honor. And he cites specifics from an affidavit on our behalf. That is that 26 states adopted verbatim. 19 adopted with amendments. And if you pursue that, it appears that maybe 10 or 11 of the 114 articles in this code tend to be amended. And the municipalities, which are very important in this regard, also widely adopted. And it says here, and I think the survey was of municipalities with over 100,000 population, 232 adopted this code exactly as written, 256 adopted it and made changes, on average, changing only 11 articles. But compare...
Mr. Frankel, could you clarify that when it says that 26 adopted it through the process of incorporation by reference? Is that a process which is what you might call year-by-year incorporation?
Does
the statute say that this code, as amended from year
from year to year shall be the governing code? Or does the legislature each year pass a separate statute?
Your Honor, the code comes out every 3 years, but I'm stalling just a bit. I have not read one of those statutes and seen exactly how they
be much more impressive, of course, if it's automatic. And if you know when you get an amendment to this, it'll automatically go into the law of some.
I would, in ignorance, settle for its not being automatic and for the legislators looking at it every three years and looking at these 700 pages and deciding that they can do no better or other than adopt this code as it is written. I want to touch on one final point of Judge Lombard's. He said you wouldn't know where to cut this off if you made this process subject to NOR, because you wouldn't know how many legislatures had to adopt it before NOR applied. Again, I want to say of Justice Black's opinion that there you had a result that comprised only one legislative veto in Pennsylvania, flowing, as the evidence showed, from that reprehensible publicity campaign. If results count, and we don't think they do because the opinion spoke of attempts to influence legislation, but if results count, then this case is more clearly within the principles of NOR than the facts of NOR itself. I do want to add, because there's been a lot of rhetoric.
Mr. Frankel, if we find that the jury was properly instructed, and if we find that the evidence supports the verdict on liability, do we still have before us here the question of damages, or is your case then concluded against you based on the finding that liability was properly?
Your Honor, we have not brought up the question of damages as such. Our petition seeks a reversal of the judgment below and or a direction to reinstate the judgment, notwithstanding the verdict. I want to say one word, because I've been very abstract, which I regret, about what really happened in this case. We have a lot of talk in the briefs about a polluted code and a tainted code and a corrupted code. What happened in this case is you had a vote that was what it was within the rules that stalled this process, that led to another look on appeal and led to a realization, in fact, that they hadn't taken enough account of the safety problem. They denied the appeal. 3 years later, as a result of this delaying action, they were still worried about safety. Now, this isn't a very elegant process, the stacking or packing or whatever it's called, but it is kin to a kind of democratic process with which the justices of this court are certainly familiar. Not always elegant, not always what a philosopher would prescribe if he wrote a democratic system, but it works. And it worked here, and in any event, above all, it is, in our submission, squarely within the NOR doctrine. I'd like to reserve a couple of minutes, if I may.
Thank you, Mr. Frankel. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Yerman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, let me begin by turning directly to NOR. As we've all heard, Justice Black focused in that case on what he described as the right of the people to inform their representatives in government of their desires with respect to the passage or enforcement of law. With that in mind, the Court held that the railroad's publicity campaign in that case, despite being deceitful and underhanded, did not violate the antitrust laws because, in the words of NOR, a publicity campaign to influence governmental action falls clearly within the category of political activity to which the Sherman Act does not apply. Congress, the Court concluded, had not intended the Sherman Act to have application in the political arena. And those are the key words, the political arena. Because none of that has anything to do with the conspiracy hatched by Allied within the confines of the National Fire Protection Association, a totally private body, a private standard-making group accountable to no one, and in the words of this Court, a group rife with opportunities for anti-competitive behavior. What happened here was nothing like what happened in Knorr. There, the railroad's publicity campaign was aimed at getting at legislation to injure the truckers, and it was obviously a public campaign in the political arena aimed at the body politic. And if all Allied and its cohorts had done in this case was to engage in a publicity campaign against Carlon and its product, none of us would be here today. But Allied did much more than that. First, they conspired with their competitors to exclude Carlon's product from the National Electrical Code, a private industry code that is a conceded fact, that conspiracy to exclude. And as the court below found, that conspiracy caused independent marketplace injury to Carlon, wholly independent of any injury caused by being excluded by law. In other words, in all of those jurisdictions where Carlon could otherwise have sold its product, notwithstanding any state action, Carlon suffered independent marketplace injury. The record is abundantly clear that the trial court charged the jury that that was what the evidence was limited to. And if we want, a little bit later, I'll get to that specific evidence. Now, Allied argues that what it did, so long as its actions were ultimately in pursuit of legislation, is somehow sheltered by Knorr. In effect, Allied seeks to duck under the Knorr umbrella by claiming that its conduct, an antitrust violation committed within the National Fire Protection Association, which standing alone caused injury to Carlon, was ultimately aimed at getting some states to enact this code.
Mr. Yerman, just by way of clarification, do you concede that your client is not entitled to damages flowing from any governmental agency's decision to adopt the National Electrical Code?
For purposes of this case, I am, Justice O'Connor.
Allied the independent marketplace injury, for example, in states that didn't adopt the code.
That's all we're talking about, exactly. That's where we were injured. That's what the trial court limited our damage claim to, and that's the injury we were awarded by the
jury. You didn't put evidence in of damages in states that adopted the code.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct. The Allied's argument cannot hold water, because violations of the antitrust laws can't fall by the wayside merely because conspirators claim that their violations were in pursuit of legislation, even if that claim were true. For example, the conspirators in the Fashion Originators case would not have been exonerated if they had proven that they engaged in their group boycott in order to spur legislation banning the sale of pirated dress designs. Such a violation stands alone, was a violation, and that was a violation of the antitrust laws, notwithstanding that maybe they did it in order to inspire Congress to pass a law. There have been district court cases in the same area, as your honors may recall, the Pennsylvania service station dealers who all boycotted the sale of gasoline for a period of time in order to spur the government to increase price support. That was rejected. Not every antecedent antitrust violation on the way to the legislature is sheltered by Knorr, and it never has been. Put simply, a private restraint does not come under Knorr merely because there's some hope or expectation of governmental endorsement. Not as here in particular, where we have an antecedent, completed antitrust violation. Conspiracy, injury, damage, all caused outside the political arena, having nothing to do with the state action, but because we were excluded from a private industry code. Allied may have hoped that by excluding us from the NEC, it might, in fact, bar us from states that would adopt that into law. But that doesn't excuse them from the damage we suffered in all of those other places where the law was never passed. And we're talking, incidentally, about roughly half the country. It's really kind of ironic when you think about it. In hydro level, there was a misinterpretation of a code. Not a word was mentioned of Knorr. In hydro level, that code, according to this court, was adopted in whole by 46 states. In fact, this court made a point of saying that the thing that made that antitrust violation in hydro level so terrible, so pernicious, was because of the governmental adoption, the importance and influence of the code. What this all comes down to is that to hold that NOR applies here would be to conclude that the Congress that enacted the Sherman Act, because I agree with Mr. Frankel that, in fact, NOR itself, Justice Black, was initially grounding it on a matter of statutory interpretation of the Sherman Act, would be to conclude that when Senator Sherman introduced the Sherman Act, he intended to insulate from all antitrust scrutiny all concerted activity in a private standard-making context, in effect to license the blatant anti-competitive conspiracy found in this case. And I submit that that simply defies logic and reason, especially in light of the legion of antitrust cases which have held over the years that private standard-making conspiracies are, in fact, subject to the rule of reason at least.
Mr. Yerman, you stated as sort of a given that this would be an antitrust violation absent the legislative involvement at the end of it all.
Yes.
Is that entirely clear? What if the jury here did find in response to the interrogatories that these defendants believed that there was a safety problem, that was at least part of their motivation? Now, what if these people had, instead of stacking the house, simply done all they could to speak eloquently and shared information and whatnot, and maybe took a 3-month course on public speaking in order to get across to the body that this thing really is dangerous? Now, would that be a violation of the
Act? Justice Scalia, I'm really glad you asked that question, because I think it goes to the heart of why NOR doesn't apply here. Let's think about this. Why are we talking about NOR? We're talking about NOR apart from statutory interpretation because of the First Amendment implications of NOR, the right to petition, the right to assemble, the right to speak, to debate, to persuade, right, to disseminate information.
I'm not asking about NOR. You understand?
Well, I do understand, and I think in this respect both the rule of reason and NOR in a way come together, because I think I can answer your question two ways. In a private standard-making organization, the answer to your question is no, there'd be no problem. Let me do that first. The answer to your question is no, they can say anything they want. Yes, they can speak in a private standard-making context. They can speak and give their views, and as far as I'm concerned, even if they were wrong, even if they made a mistake.
But what if they were evilly motivated, that they gave their views, but their intent was to suppress competition?
I think at that point I'd have a problem. Now, I mean, I don't have that case here. I think in a private standard-making context, which is subject to the rule of reason, the intentional submission of incorrect data in a conspiratorial context to exclude a product from the marketplace, I think is something a jury, a finder of fact, would weigh heavily in determining.
No, but correct data. We're talking correct data here.
Correct data.
Not incorrect data.
Then I have no problem at all.
Even though they talk with one another, and of course, to say that they're not motivated by anti-competitive considerations is absurd. I mean, otherwise they'd say, yeah, it's unsafe, but I'm not going to make a big deal about it. What really gets them motivated to take the rhetoric courses and to share the information is the competitive feature. That would still be all right.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the essence of private standard.
Even if they get together and publish a pamphlet.
Yes.
Jointly.
Yes.
To express their views.
Yes, Justice O'Connor, that goes on every day in private standard making, and I have no problem with that.
So does stacking meetings. If it happened in the Congress, you'd say, boy, what a legislative genius, whoever put that together was. Or if it happened in the Iowa caucuses, you'd say somebody was really thinking. That's very clever Democratic politicking. Now, this was within the rules here, wasn't it?
That's the root of the issue. Okay. First of all, within the rules, Allied conceded in its brief in the Court of Appeals below that what we had here was a potential for abuse. That's how they describe the rules situation of the NFPA. The NFPA had rules that allowed someone, unfortunately in this case, to circumvent their procedures and to subvert the consensus standard-making process in order to come up with a consensus on this issue that was different from the consensus that otherwise would have been achieved if they had followed the NFPA procedures. I would urge you to review the briefs and the record on this, because that was the specific jury finding. They talk a lot in their brief about this subversion thing being somewhat ambiguous or vague, or what does it mean? Well, A, let's remember a couple of things. First, they never objected to the question being put to the jury. B, they never objected to the instruction to the jury on what it was all about. And C, what was it all about? What it was all about was, and the jury was instructed to a fare thee well on this, and they put in evidence to a fare thee well on this, that the NFPA operates under certain standards and procedures. Sure, it has some rules, but there was a loophole, and they drove a truck through the loophole and thereby subverted the procedures and produced a result that otherwise would not have been producible. Now, they came in, and I argue, just like they're talking here, this was everyday stuff. It goes on all the time. There was a history of this at the NFPA. Nobody considered it wrong. Nobody thought there was anything improper about it. They argued all of that to the jury, and the judge told the jury to consider all that. In a rule of reason context, consider whether this was all correct or proper, and the jury rejected it out of hand. They said, absolutely not. This was a subversion of the process. Now, I will agree there were verdicts.
How does that constitute an antitrust violation? I mean, maybe we can put them in jail if there's some statute that says you shall not subvert the rules of private organizations. But we're talking here about an unreasonable restraint of trade. Now, the effect is reasonable or unreasonable no matter how it's achieved. The motivation, safety or no safety, is either reasonable or unreasonable no matter what techniques are used. How does the fact that they violate, the rules of the Marquis of Salisbury, whoever makes rules for not packing organization, how does that make this an unreasonable restraint of trade?
The jury was instructed on this as well, and it's the same way that you do any rule of reason analysis. Let me begin, first of all, by pointing out that in the hydro-level case, there was a misinterpretation of a standard, all right? It was not, as Mr. Frankel points out, price fixing. It wasn't a classic group boycott like in fashion originators. But this court in hydro level had no problem understanding and holding that when a couple of competitors fool around with a code and put out some phony interpretation, that was clearly a conspiracy to exclude the competitor's product by making it impossible for him to sell it. And that's what they did in hydro level, and that was a violation. But let me answer your question on the rule of reason, Judge Scalia, if you'd like me to, please. What happened here is there was a rule of reason analysis. You start out with the fundamentals of private standard making. Private standard making, with all due respect, are walking conspiracies. There are a bunch of competitors who sit around deciding which of their competitors' products will be allowed in and which are going to be excluded. The law over the years has evolved under the rule of reason to permit private standard making because the dissemination of information, in a nutshell, the dissemination of information, the promulgation of meritorious standards is thought to be pro-competitive. And it's that pro-competitive benefit that outweighs the anti-competitive side of having some products excluded. This is all rather run-of-the-mill. Now, what happened here? What happened here was a bunch of competitors get together and conspire to subvert this meritorious standard-making process, to come up with a standard, in effect, with an exclusion that wasn't based on the merits, to use this as a way to block someone's product. All right? Just like the conspirators in hydro level got together to misinterpret the code to exclude their competitor's product.
Excuse me, you're stacking it by saying that wasn't based on the merits. The jury found that they truly believed it was unsafe. As far as they were concerned, it was based on the merits. Some of the subsequent history seems to indicate that it may have been based on the merits. The only thing you're complaining about is using rules which didn't really violate any of the principles of the association, but which you think are unfair.
Justice Scalia, I don't think I'm stacking it because, as Justice Stevens held in Professional Engineers, especially in a standard-making context, your own view of the safety of the product, your reason for violating the antitrust laws because you think it's unsafe, is irrelevant. As Justice Stevens described it, that type of philosophy would be a frontal assault on the Sherman Act. And that is totally rejected. Whether they thought it was safe or unsafe does not license them to subvert the standard and come up with a non-meritorious standard. When I say meritorious, Justice Scalia, what I mean, and let me be clear on this, is the consensus that otherwise would have been reached in that private standard-making body but for the corruption. In any private standard-making debate, one side's going to be right.
What's your definition of corruption?
In this case, corruption in this case was, in effect, the dilution of the votes of all.
But there was no rule against dilution of votes.
There was no specific rule that said that. That is correct. But I don't think you can hold the private standard-making process and the rule of reason analysis of whether private standard-making is lawful or not up to a standard where the organization promulgates rules, and if their rule isn't violated, everything they do is okay.
Well, is it just a question then the jury decides on all the evidence whether something was, quote, corrupt, close quote, or not?
In this case, in effect, yes, that's right. That's right. I mean, it's a tough case to prove. I think you'd have a...
Any question or is there any issue here before us as to the as to the correctness of the legal rules the district court applied?
The charge was never objected to. The rule
and,
of reason
so
charge came in without objection.
The issue is just whether there any jury could have found under these instructions.
That's not an issue either, Justice White. That's not been questioned. The jury verdicts have not been questioned in terms of sufficiency.
question about the Sherman Act is involved here?
I think that they argue that there is no rule of reason violation here based upon the evidence as a matter of law.
All right. Then the question is there enough evidence to support the jury's verdict?
Well, I really don't think that's the question, because I think that the jury sufficiency issue is already resolved. I think perhaps you could look at all this, I suppose, take the whole case and say we think that on this record this is not a rule of reason violation.
I take it your brief here, this red brief, the second question you list is if petitioner's conspiracy was not immunized by the Knorr Doctrine, was there evidence to support the jury's determination that the conspiracy in question unreasonably restrained trade? I just ask you if that is
fair
an
enough.
Issue.
That is fair enough, and I'm not trying to walk away from that. All I am saying is I don't think there's an issue of evidentiary sufficiency here, and I think perhaps you're right. That could have been put more felicitously.
I think it was put more felicitously in the petition. The second question was whether, even without regard to the Knorr Doctrine, such lobbying and voting tactics, otherwise lawful and in compliance with the rules of a code-making association, are proscribed by the Sherman Act if a jury finds they, quote, subvert the rules.
Fair enough.
I would agree with that.
Fair enough. And I apologize for the ambiguity, Justice White, but I really think that is what the issue is. On the issue of the inconsistency of the verdicts and the talking about no violation of rules and so forth, the jury and the trial court had no problem understanding, based upon the evidence here, why, even though there were these rules under all of the evidence put in concerning how the NFPA operated, what the NFPA's overall policies, standards, and what everybody in that organization understood its objectives and standards to be, that this was in fact a corruption of its process, that this was in fact the achievement of a consensus other than the consensus that would have been achieved. When the plaintiff argued below that the verdicts were inconsistent, something not before you today, the judge held that it's not inconsistent, the fact that there was a finding of subversion even though there was a finding that the rules weren't violated or there was an effective appeal. He said, that is not consistent. You know it. You argued to the jury there was no violation of the rules, and the jury found that. But I told the jury they were entitled to consider on a rule of reason analysis whether or not, even though you technically complied with the rules, whether or not you subverted the spirit of the rules as well as their letter. So that finding is totally not consistent. Indeed, that is precisely the answer we contemplated when we put to the jury. And he goes on that way to point out that he found there was nothing inconsistent. And I would point out, of course, that at this level, it is hardly the time to start looking into inconsistencies, especially where the rule is very clear that if the verdicts can be read in any way to be consistent, then the verdict is to be sustained. And I think the trial court and the court of appeals both have reviewed that issue and both have found the jury's verdicts were consistent.
Was the word consensus in the organization's bylaws?
Oh, absolutely. It's all over the place. I mean, that's what this organization is all about, is consensus. Now, let me just say one other thing.
Just let me ask one before we get off. Suppose they hadn't gotten new members within the 30, you know, before the 30-day deadline, but had simply called up all of the people, all of their steel-making conduit buddies and said, it's an important vote. We think this stuff is unsafe. More important, it's really going to hurt our business. Make sure that all of your people who are members get out for this meeting. Would that have been a subversion?
Well, it's kind of hard to answer that because the issue of that wasn't necessarily raised. My tendency would have think probably not.
That's my difficulty. Well, I'm concerned about these organizations. I think they fulfill an important role, and it seems to me we have to adopt a rule that makes the people that participate in them know what constitutes a trouble damage liability or not.
I agree, Justice Scalia. I don't mean to try to answer your question. Let me just say that I think it's a tough case, and I started to say that before. It will be a very tough case to persuade a jury that in the context of all of the proceedings that go on, in the context of the history of the organization and so forth, that someone corrupted the process by producing a consensus that otherwise wouldn't have been achieved. I think that's going to be a very hard thing to get a jury verdict on. It wasn't easy for us. What made it easy here in this case was because the action was so far away from anything that this organization had ever seen or done, was so far outside what was considered to be acceptable behavior in this organization under their procedures, that it was clearly a violation.
How can you tell that it was so far outside of what was considered acceptable behavior?
Chief Justice Rehnquist, you tell that by submitting to the jury, as Ally did, a history of what went on in that organization, of what kinds of things were being done, of what people understood was permissible and what people understood was not permissible. By putting in...
Even though not based on any rule of the organization?
Well... Yes.
I asked you a question.
Yes.
Was it or was it not based on any rule of the organization?
It was not based on a specific rule,
Was it based on an unspecific rule?
Yes, it was based upon a standard that everyone understood in that organization that you are not supposed to achieve a result on a vote in that organization by dominating the meeting with a commercial interest. That's what everyone understood, that you're not supposed to take a standard which is up for review by that organization, and bring in as many people as are allied to you, pay their expenses to Boston for the meeting, 220 votes, so that you can achieve a consensus that is different from what otherwise would have been achieved on the merits. You can lobby, you can speak, you can talk to all the people who would otherwise be coming, you can try to make sure there's an important discussion of this. But you shouldn't change what the vote otherwise would have been.
How do you know whether you're changing what the vote would otherwise have been?
You know it when you bring in 220 people, you pay their expenses, they're know-nothing voters, they don't know what they're voting on, they're not participating in the debate, they have nothing to say about anything other than they were trucked up to Boston to vote no on the project, and nothing on the product, nothing like that's ever happened before, and everyone in the meeting...
No expenses had ever been paid before, of anyone ever been paid before?
Not for 220 people.
Well, what's the cutoff?
There were 300, the vote turned out to be 394 to 390, okay? If they had brought 10 people, and if they could have shown that over the years they normally brought 5, I don't think we'd have a lawsuit.
So every one of these questions then goes to the jury, because there's no such thing as a summary judgment for a defendant, because it's always a question of degree that has to be answered by the jury.
Well, let me turn it around just for a second, Justice Rehnquist, because I don't suggest that this is that easy a question, but let's think about the alternative for a second. You have a private standard-making association. Put NOR aside for a minute. You have a private standard-making association that has the power to exclude a product from the marketplace. Are we saying that under the antitrust laws, the question of whether a new and innovative product gets into the code, gets into the marketplace, is strictly a matter of which company has enough money to bring enough people to private standard-making meetings to block it or not block it? I mean, is that what the result is? Because that's the result you're left with unless you're prepared to deal with this question. And simply to say, well, the organization didn't have a rule against it, leaves us at sea.
Not quite. You still have to have a jury finding that these people were motivated, at least in part, although that may not have been worth the plane fare, at least in part, by the fact they really believed this stuff was unsafe.
Well,
and that doesn't create such a terrible system. You say, you know, we're harnessing the power of greed to make sure that unsafe products don't get onto the marketplace. Of course, the competitors will be the one who are interested about it, but that achieves some social good, you might say.
The point, the answer to that, I think, Justice Scalia, is that the point made in Professional Engineers about safety was that people can't dictate what goes on the market or not because of they think it's safe or not safe. You take this product. Mr. Frankel made a whole point about how it was excluded in 80. It came in 83 with a three-story limit. In 87, the three-story limit was dropped. The product is not unsafe. There was a debate about it. There are debates about a lot of products. Just because you can marshal enough evidence to say, I think there's something wrong with this product, what product is there out there that you could not legitimately prove, I genuinely think there's something wrong with it? And then I come into this private standard-making association with that finding, Justice Scalia, and please do not put aside the fact there was a concession in the case that they had an anti-competitive motive. They conceded they wanted to exclude the product for commercial reasons as well. So all they have to do is find one little piece of information, one scientist who says, I think there's a problem with this, and you're home free, bring all the votes you can, truck them up to Boston, and you're out of the code, and forget the Sherman Act. I just don't think you can be left with that kind of result. I agree. It's not that easy a line to draw when the consensus standard-making process and private standard-making is subverted, but I think a line has to be drawn, and I think it was easily drawn here. One last thing, if I can just get this out on Knorr, and I don't want to forget this. Knorr was brought to preserve speech, debate, persuasion, as I said before. Wouldn't it be the supreme irony if in the name of preserving the right to debate and give information, you allow a procedure that says, and when all is said and done, all the debate is out the window, all the information that was disseminated you can forget about because we're bringing in 220 know-nothings who don't care what that information is, they're voting no. Don't I have Knorr rights too? Don't I have a right to know that when I make an argument, when I make a debate, when I give information, that when the vote comes in, people are going to vote on the merits, and the vote will reflect the information. In this case, my Knorr rights disappear because everything I said didn't matter. There were 220 people who came in and outvoted me, not because of any information or anything else. One last word. If, for any reason, and I would, of course, respectfully argue that it ought not to be, you were inclined to apply Knorr in this situation, then I would urge you to look closely at the sham ruling in the Sessions decision, which is also before you on a cert petition now. In the Ninth Circuit, on similar facts, although different, Sessions, all the people that were voters were government officials, and there was no injury other than injury from the statute. And both of those are very important distinctions from us in Sessions. So I'm not re-arguing Sessions. But what the Sessions court said was, we think, and they analyzed this out to say Knorr should apply, but they said, nevertheless, looking at the Second Circuit, we disagree with their Knorr reasoning, but clearly what happened in the Second Circuit would be a sham. And I would say to you, this too should be a sham, even if Knorr applies. What greater sham is there than, after you've had all this, the Knorr-protected speech, to in effect block us, take us out of the whole tribunal, take us out of this legislature, bring in 220 new legislators, and let them vote us down? If you're going to analogize this situation to a legislative situation, the NFPA is somehow thought of like a legislature. You can say anything. You can give information. You can give wrong information. Maybe even you can lie. But what you can't do when all is said and done, when that's finished, is truck in 222 new legislators who are on your payroll and get them to vote it down. Where does that leave the Knorr-protected speech? What's the sense of having Knorr if the speech doesn't matter? Are there any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Yearman. Mr. Frankel, you have 2 minutes remaining.
In 2 minutes, I must be blunt, if the Court please. The answer Mr. Yearman gave to Justice O'Connor's questions about independent marketplace injury are incorrect. The complaint rested on injury caused by the enactment of this code into statutes. When they were trying to beat off a judgment NOV, Judge Sprizzo said, I think your theory of damages all along was that your damages flowed from the fact that you were not approved and therefore not adopted by state legislatures involved. As to the proof of damages, the Court will find no evidence allegedly segregating so-called independent marketplace injury from the broad injury that their expert testified to, which all came from not being adopted.
Look at the verdict. I understand you're arguing about the damage. May I ask you a question about your Knorr theory?
Yes, sir.
Would it apply equally if in this case they had adopted a rule giving the steel conduit people a veto over any change in specification?
If the NFPA had such a rule?
By reason of, say, lobbying the steel conduit people, instead of lobbying about this, got such a rule adopted.
In the NFPA?
Yes.
Your Honor, it would be a weird rule, and I would try very hard to help Mr. Yearman find a theory that would find it invalid. But it's impossible to have an interest-representing agency, as this one is, frankly, continuing to function and giving that kind of dictatorial power to any one of the interests.
Is this case really different from that?
Pardon?
Is this case really different from that?
I think the case is utterly different, Your Honor. I think, as the NFPA says, this is a place where all interests can come and debate. After their vote, the higher-ups in the agency will review what has happened with plenary authority to overturn it.
You rest on the proposition. This case is different than the hypothetical one I give you. You don't argue that NOR would apply in my hypothetical.
Your Honor, I don't argue that. I don't know with the red light on whether I can tell the Chief Justice that there was also...
I don't think you should, Mr. Frankel. Your time has expired. The case is submitted.
Thank you, sir.